Hey Mud Podcast presents.
And good evening. Welcome to Global Stuff. My name's Jimmy Derschlag. And so glad to be back in the studio. It's been a few months. I've been doing a pre-recorded show, but it's nice to be back here and doing it live, and that gives you a chance. In a little while, we'll open phone lines and take some questions. But this evening, I'm very pleased to be discussing a topic that we've had a few times before, and that is discussing the issue of fascism and the far right and its impact. My guest for the show this evening is Craig Johnson, who is in the history department, teaches in the history department at the University of California in Berkeley. He received his PhD in Latin American history there. His areas of focus, in addition to Latin American history, are fascism and the Catholic Church, sometimes the intersection of all three. He does a weekly podcast, 15 Minutes of Fascism. We're going to talk about his brand new book that just came out, among other things, How to Talk to Your Son About Fascism. Welcome to the show, Dr. Johnson. So glad to have you with us.
Thank you so much. Glad to be here.
Thanks for making the time. So often my guests are on the East Coast, and I have to I have to make them stay up late on a Friday. So you don't get, you're here with us on the West Coast in Berkeley.
No, this is all good. Very easy for me.
Yeah, and of course, many connections between Berkeley and a lot of the folks up here in Humboldt County.
Oh, I've been up there very often. Love the country.
Yeah, it's a beautiful spot. And as I mentioned, we've talked about this a few times. We had Mike German on the show talking about the infiltration of white supremacy into the FBI and other local law enforcement. We had Elizabeth Minnick on, whose most recent book she updated, The Evil of Banality on the Life and Death Importance of Thinking, which talks about intensive evil, not eagles, but evil, which is directly related to fascism and the many of the trends of fascism in Italy and Germany and around the world. But your book takes a very special approach to it, although I think it's more general than just, you know, how to talk to your son about fascism, because it covers a lot of the history of fascism and how it affects all of us. But it comes from, seems to me, from a very specific need that you see to really find a way to deal with the way fascism in the U.S. and elsewhere is going after and recruiting and a lot of young men who are vulnerable to those kind of arguments. What would you say was your impetus behind the book?
Well, there were two main things, two main reasons that I wanted to write the book. The first one is, like you said, I'm an academic by training, and when an academic doesn't know the answer to a question, they write a book. And so I was trying to come up with practical advice for people about how to deal with fascism, how to deal with the rise of fascism. And that was because, you know, as a person who studies fascism professionally, when I first started doing this back in 2014, people thought that it was, you know, maybe a weird little curiosity. And then with the first Trump administration, people stopped thinking that and they started asking me, horrified, what can I do about this, you know? And I wanted to write a book to answer that question, and so I did.
And what is it about that made you focus so much on younger men and the need to find a way to talk to them? I don't know if you're a father yourself, but I'm assuming that you're aware of parents who have been in this situation, and from your own personal history, experiencing some of the right-wing hate. You mentioned that in your book. But what stood out to you about the way these organizations are going after younger men?
Yeah, I mean, on a personal level, my primary experience with the rise of the right wing has been as an educator, teaching at Berkeley over the last over a decade at this point, first in graduate school and now teaching independently. I've just seen changes in how students talk, changes in how students' politics are. White supremacy is just a much more normal political belief for kids to have. This isn't something that happened in my classroom, but I had a colleague who came to me and was just like, today a kid raised his hand and asked me, you know, hey, but isn't like doesn't immigration dilute the Anglo-Saxon nature of the United States? And that's just like, I mean, that's a bizarre thing to say. It's crazy, first of all. But second of all, it's actual fascist talking points. And here they are being disseminated not just at a university, but at one of the most elite universities in the country, Berkeley, and at a public school in one of the most diverse states in the country. Things are just changing. Right wing is more powerful now. It's more widespread. It's more popular. As for the reason that I wanted to write a book about young men, the reason that I like to give is fascism appeals to young men, and I mean that in two senses. Fascism appeals to young men because it's an ideology that is associated with masculinity, with youth, with power, with truth instead of fact, you know, with sort of poetry instead of prose. Fascists believe in, you know, speed and verve. And those are things that we definitely associate in the Western world with young people. The other reason is that fascists intentionally appeal to young men, like the verb appeal. They seek out young men to join their ranks. And that's because they need young men to do the dirty work. You know, the 40-year-olds, 50-year-olds, 60-year-olds who found and lead these movements, they're generally not out there actually protesting or fighting. Those guys are behind the scenes directing people to go out and potentially get arrested.
And you discuss in your first chapter exactly what is fascism. As you've mentioned, people tend to throw that term around for any government or political movement that they may not agree with, that they see themselves as on the other side of. But really, it's very specific in how it operates and what it's about. How would you define fascism?
You're absolutely right that most of the time I think we end up hearing about fascism as a, you know, as an insult, right? And it just means anybody to the right of me, or even sometimes to the left, you know, Donald Trump even going so far as to, you know, potentially call the nominee for the Democrats for the mayorship of New York a fascist, right? Or saying like fascists or communists or communists or fascists or something like that.
Yeah, they want to get, someone wants to deport him even.
Just, exactly, yeah. No. Fascism is something specific. It is a political movement on the right wing that is revolutionary and violent. And all of those, all the parts of that definition are important. Fascism is revolutionary. They want to completely remake the world. They don't just want to turn back the clock. They want to build a new and different world. Another big thing that makes fascism different from other movements on the right wing, you know, like conservatives or in other countries, you know, people want to bring a king back or something like that. The thing that makes fascism different from almost every other political movement is that fascists don't just believe that violence might be useful. They don't just think that violence is something that they might want to use in order to achieve, you know, one of their goals. Fascists believe that violence is good. They think that it is good to be violent, and they think that it is good to experience violence. This is why fascists today are often found in and organizing in martial arts cultures, fight clubs. This is why they do paramilitary trainings and paramilitary exercises. This is why fascism originally appeared among veterans in World War I. Fascism, put simply, believes that violence is good. It thinks that it is good for people to perpetrate violence, and it is good for people to risk their lives violently.
And that, in some ways, you talk about how does this appeal to young men, and I think we all know that young men have a lot of extra energy, and yet they're being told to contain that. And they're also, in our society nowadays, rightfully so, they're being, you know, sort of directed to kind of tune into their feelings, their emotions, to be sensitive about other people. And yet they have, you know, a lot of other things going on, whether it's their hormones or whatever else, other developments are happening in their lives. And that kind of macho approach can be very appealing to them.
Absolutely. The growth of fascism today, just like back in the 1920s and 1930s, it's part of a crisis of masculinity. People talk about, you know, masculine fragility and things like that. What that means, what people mean by that, is that what it means to be a man is fragile. It's delicate. There are a whole bunch of things that men are not allowed to do. And there are only a few things that are defined as definitely manly, right? And fascism taps into every single one of those things and tells you, like, you don't need to be in touch with your feelings. You don't need to hear about other people's feelings. You don't need to care about any of that stuff. Fascism appeals to a lot of young men who, you know, want the promise that their grandparents had or that their parents had of a single income earner. Fascists promise young men that they can be in charge of a family in the way that people were back in the 1920s, 30s, 40s, and 50s. They want to go back to a pre-feminist world. But like I said, you can't really turn back the clock. Fascists instead want to build something sort of more nakedly male supremacist out of those things. So this is why fascists today don't just advocate for sort of like euphemisms for male supremacism. They just say that outright, even to the extent that many fascist advocates today openly advocate for the legalization of rape or sexual violence.
And a few of the other things in your first chapter where you're talking about what is fascism, again, the book we're talking about that it just came out by Dr. Craig Johnson, my guest here, How to Talk to Your Son About Fascism, but really covers the gamut in what fascism is about in getting to that place, is there's a few other things related to what you've already been talking about, that it's sexist. It's built on sexism and putting women in a certain role. How would you describe that?
Yeah, this is one of the things that again differentiates fascism from a lot of other political movements. Fascism is inherently sexist. It is about male power. It's about it's about male social dominance. When people talk about fascism, they often focus on its racism. And it is true that most fascisms, like most varieties of fascism, are racist. But there have been several that aren't about race, and many that, if they are about race, they're not about whiteness. So for example, fascist organization in India are not organized around white supremacy. You know, they're about Hindu supremacy or Indian supremacy, right? As opposed to Muslim people. But every single variety of fascism that I've ever heard of believes that men should be in charge and that women should be subordinate and submissive and subservient. Almost all fascist movements are overwhelmingly male in terms of their membership and their makeup.
And another one of the characteristics that you discuss is that they don't play by the rules. I guess maybe that's kind of obvious from some of the things we're talking about. And, you know, I don't necessarily think that the current administration is outright sexist, although there certainly are many aspects of that. But that certainly comes into play currently in the defiance of the judicial branch and rulings and things like that. So that seems to fall into that category. But as you point out, they don't really care about the legality, due process. That's kind of part of the creed.
Exactly. Yes. So when I was talking about how fascists believe in violence, that's part of this. Violence is to them, it's a purpose in and of itself. Fascists believe that they're going to get what they want and they're not going to play by the rules. And by the rules, I mean any rules, all rules, like rules of war, rules of engagement, rules of how democracy works. They just don't care. They will use whatever tools are available to them. They will kill people. They will torture people. They'll steal elections. They'll lie. They'll cheat. They'll do whatever. This is because, essentially, because they're like really instrumentalist revolutionaries. They'll just do whatever they want.
I do want to remind the listeners, this is Global Stuff. My guest is Dr. Greg Johnson, teaches in the History Department of the University of California in Berkeley. He has focused on Latin America and fascism, the Catholic Church. He hosts the 15 Minutes of Fascism podcast, which is, I noticed it varies a little bit between 13 and 17, but you're
That's
pretty,
true.
You're pretty close to 15.
15 is an average. Yes. As a podcaster, I'm not constrained by the radio hours.
And look that up. It's very interesting. He does that every week. And covers usually updates on what we're talking about now, various fascist elements, but also tying it to things in the news that are going on and positive things that are happening in relation to pushing back against fascism. So I people can go to 15 Minutes of Fascism .com, I think is the 15minutesoffascism.com, mm-hmm. and you can see all of the episodes. And 15 minutes, it's an easy listen, so it's I'm not putting a lot on you to check that out. But the other thing that you point out, you know, we don't really think about, okay, the Republicans in Congress, they're definitely led by the right, and they're definitely under the thumb of the Trump administration. We don't think of them as fascists, but as you point out, it's often the conservatives, the right wing, who utilize that, like the Proud Boys or other groups, to be they can be the public front without them getting exposed.
That's exactly right. Just like we were talking about before, people use fascism as an insult all the time. And like, frankly, you know, fine. Like if you're at a protest and you're screaming at somebody and you call them a fascist, like, okay, whatever, that's okay. But when we're talking about trying to analyze our political world and understand it in a more deep way, you're absolutely right. When we think about Donald Trump, you know, ask yourself, like, what does he really believe? What does he really want? Personally, I don't think he's really a true believer in almost anything at all.
Yeah, I agree with that.
I think he wants power and money. And he happens to have found a niche there. And that niche that he found is by incorporating previously unthinkable elements in the U.S. political world into mainstream electoral politics. And those unthinkable elements are actual fascists. Before, conservatives used to hold them sort of at arm's length or potentially even further away, right? There were times when conservatives in the United States would maybe use the Klan, right, to take out some leftists or something, or they would look the other way when fascists would show up and rough people up or destroy, you know, an office of some organizers or something like that. A really perfect example of this is what happened in Nazi Germany when Hitler took power. The Nazis, when they took power in Germany, won about 30% of the vote. Most of the rest of the vote went to communists and socialists, and some of the rest of it went to mainstream conservatives. The mainstream conservatives sided with the Nazis in order to keep the socialists and communists out of power, thinking to themselves, okay, don't worry about it. These fascist people, will use them to do our dirty work, and then we'll jettison them afterwards, and then we'll be in power again like we always are.
Right.
But it didn't work out like that, right? Instead, the fascists pulled the rug out and took over the coalition. What we're seeing right now in the United States is that Donald Trump has brought the fascists into the coalition. And what we don't know, what we're going to be finding out and fighting over for the next 10 years, is who's going to be in control of the right wing. Is it going to be the relatively mainstream right wing who now have these buddies, the fascists? Or are the fascists going to actually end up taking over the coalition? And that remains to be seen. We probably won't know that until 2028 or maybe the 2030s.
And I think you're pointing out to a potential parallel to what you're talking about in Germany when, you know, the people with power and influence who were not fascist were thinking, oh, well, you know, we'll be back in power. And that kind of is a parallel to the Republican Party right now, when many of us are saying, wait a second, you know, okay, you're Republican, you're conservative, but this is not the traditional way that the party has operated. The ignorance of the separations of power, the putting in place people incompetent, and that's being generous, incompetent people into government to run the highest departments, and just bending over to that. But that leaves an opening for, you know, it's not necessarily something that's so easy to come back from.
Oh, no. I mean, right now in the Republican Party, I think that we see about four different groups that make up the party. We have the actual fascists, so like Proud Boys, people like that. We have the Christian nationalists, so this is like the W. Bush people. We have some like techno-libertarian types, you know, like your Elon Musks, people like that. And then you have the mainstream of the Republican Party, people who, you know, for lack of a better term, we might call Romney Republicans, you know, people who want a Republican Party and they look back at Reagan or something like that, and they want, you know, what they consider to be good governance, or they want relatively conservative social values. This is the Republican Party that was going to nominate Jeb Bush in 2016, right? But Donald Trump derailed that whole project and took over the party by bringing in more fringe elements, Christian nationalists and white supremacists.
And as you say about the fascists, they don't play by the rules. So in a way, they don't really care about the Republican Party. That's not their interest. Their interest is in whatever branded party they have that will they can take over, and whatever, whether it's they become the National Socialists or whatever, if they really get in power, they'll be their own. It won't be, maybe they'll take over the Republican Party and still keep calling it that, but that's not their concern, is the Republican Party.
No, no, no. They don't care about the Republican Party as such. They're using it because it's what's useful to use. Back when the first Ku Klux Klan was around, you know, back in the 1860s and 70s, they were working with the Democratic Party because the Democratic Party was the racist Southern Party. Fascists just don't care about those things. They'll use whatever's available to them.
Well, in a little while, we'll open up the phone lines. Before we do that, though, I do want to get back to what is the crux of your book. I know you go through the history of fascism, and we won't go into that here, but that is, I think you really are, it's definitely worth looking at how that has arisen. And as a political force, it's actually not very old, 100 years back to after World War One, and Mussolini as being the major early part of that, and other martyrs like Horst Wessel you talk about. But I do want to get to some of the crux of the book and go from there, and which is the whole notion of how the extreme right, the fascists, are affecting our culture right now, especially their influence on young men. The book is How to Talk to Your Son About Fascism, and how it's so important to know why and how that's going on and how we can push back against that. And I think we see from the media and get this image of kind of disaffected young men. They're alone in their rooms, in their house, their parents, you know, maybe they interact with their parents, but maybe they're in their own world, they're on their computers, they're experiencing social media, and through that, they're kind of ready, they're exposed to a lot of different viewpoints, and the way the far right goes at them is not straightforward. They don't come out with their viewpoints of we're going to overthrow the government, we hate women and black people. They come out with a front that's meant to be appealing as kind of a way to suck them in. Can you talk about that a little bit, about the ways that young men, for example, get exposed through their... We know young people are constantly experiencing social media. That shouldn't be new to anybody. but how they get exposed that way and the techniques that are being used?
Absolutely. the metaphor to use here is a Trojan horse, right? If the Greeks had shown up at Troy and said, hey, we're going to invade your city, they would have been turned away. But so they wrapped their invasion in a gift, right? Fascists are doing exactly the same thing. They're not showing up in your son or your grandkid or your nephew or, you know, a student in your class. They're not showing up in their media feeds or on websites wearing a swastika. They're not doing that. They're showing up as a joke. They're showing up in a fun podcast. They're showing up in a comedy skit. They're showing up in, you know, in a video game chat. Fascists use a lot of tools and a lot of online subcultures in order to try to make their messages easier to digest for people. So one really great example would be fitness influencing. So like, let's imagine that there's a 12-year-old that maybe it's your kid, maybe it's your nephew, maybe he's in your classroom, maybe you teach him a Bible study, whatever, some kid that you know. And you find out like, oh, this kid is getting into bodybuilding. He's getting into weightlifting. Okay, seems like an innocuous hobby for a kid to have. Healthy, right? Good, whatever. So this kid starts looking on YouTube and he looks up guides for how to do a particular lift. And he clicks on a couple of them and he watches a couple of them. Well, now YouTube decides, okay, well, you like videos from these kinds of people. Well, some of those people, some fitness influencers, not all of them, but some of them, have other content on their websites or have other content on their account. Maybe they talk about dating advice. And okay, well, so now this kid has moved from learning how to do a proper deadlift to learning how to date women, quote unquote. And then that leads directly into a lot of misogynist content about like ways to manipulate women in order to get them to date you. And once you're watching content that is about how to manipulate women, well, now the algorithm knows that you're somebody who might be interested in extreme right-wing content. This is just one path that some of this stuff follows. Other ones might be video game-related content, video game news, also just sort of like transgressive comedy in general. Fascists know that these pathways exist. They built them, and they exploit them on purpose. They make entry-level content that maybe has just a little hint of some of their sexist or racist or anti-Semitic or anti-government ideas. And the idea is to get it into the kid's mind, get it into the kid's sort of social world, get it into his lexicon without him knowing about it. And then, and this is unfortunately the brilliant part because they're very good at this, the brilliant part is that if you, as an educator, as a parent, as a relative, hear about this stuff and you sort of explode and are like, what are you doing? Like, why are you watching all of this crazy stuff? This is racist, this is sexist, this is anti-Semitic. Then that means that suddenly they got him. Because now the kid sees you as the outsider telling him what to do. He's the oppressed person. I'm not allowed to think these things. My God, the fascists, they were telling me that, you know, their beliefs are being oppressed. Freedom of speech isn't real. You're not allowed to criticize these things. And the kid sees that and experiences it as true. The fascists do this on purpose, and it has worked. And I do not mean this as an exaggeration. It has worked millions of times. This is why these ideas are so palatable and part of how young people think today. It's because they've made these amazing, amazing Trojan horses.
And as you say, they're kind of ready to not just take a different path than what their parents are telling them is the right way, and hear their parents. And we'll talk about that more. I often think that a lot of this book is a good guide to parenting, whether you're talking about fascism or not.
Absolutely, it is.
Because you talk so much about empathy, listening, asking questions, you know. But I think it's so easy as a parent, and it's been a while since my kids have been that age, but it's so easy to, you know, try and dominate them, and it doesn't work very well.
KMUD is a community radio station in the Redwood region of Northern California. Donate to support people-powered radio at kmud.org.
Again, I want to remind the listeners, this is Global Stuff. My name's Jimmy Derschlag. My guest for this show, Dr. Craig Johnson. He's been teaching for 10 years in the History Department of the University of California, Berkeley, which, of course, many of us here know well. And he has been talking about fascism, Latin American history. The Catholic Church has a weekly podcast, 15 Minutes of Fascism. And we're talking about his book. It's just come out. It's not a very long book, How to Talk to Your Son About Fascisms, but it's packed full. I will say that.
I didn't want to write a long book. I wanted parents to be able to read it.
Well, it's definitely got a lot of stuff in there, though. I won't say you shortchanged us at all with the information that's in there. So I know we don't need to go into a great deal of detail about the influencers, but there are, and also what you say, which I think is so important, you know, you talk about methods of kind of moderating what your kids are looking at and at least being tuned into that. But, you know, trying to shut it out completely, number one, doesn't work. But the second thing is they're going to get exposed. What you're saying is, you know, when I was growing up, you know, in the dark ages, we didn't get exposed to this. You know, certainly there was bigotry and racism, and I experienced anti-Semitism myself, but there wasn't this ubiquitous fascist tendencies that we see now. And the mere fact that people mention Nazis as a positive thing and in the media, and that's actually in the media, and you see that fairly frequently, that just didn't happen. But now they're not going to be able to avoid that. Even if you as a parent or an advising elder friend to a younger person try to shut it out, you're not going to be able to stop them from getting exposure to that.
That's exactly right. And what you were saying earlier about, you know, a lot of the advice in this book is really translatable. It's usable about, you know, all sorts of other things that might be going on in a young kid's life. And that's because, you know, the way to be present for and to help out a young person, there's pretty clear ways to do it. You know, it's through empathy, it's through love, it's through understanding and kindness and curiosity. And so this means that, like, talking to a kid about fascism, it's going to look and sound a lot like talking to a kid about sexual health, or talking to a kid about the problems of racism and sexism, or talking to a kid about anti-Semitism. But the difference between those conversations and talking to a kid about fascism is that we're familiar with those conversations. You know, everybody either has or has heard a joke about the talk, quote unquote, about sex, right? But almost nobody alive today in the United States grew up in a time when fascism was as big or as prevalent as it is now. You would have to be 100 in order to have been around the last time that fascism was this powerful in the United States. And so most of the people who have kids now, you know, people who are in their 30s, 40s, and 50s, they're totally unfamiliar with this. The world was not like this before, which is totally unlike, you know, talking to your kid about the problems of drug addiction or about sexual health, things that you probably are familiar with. How to talk to people about, you have examples from your own life, you have empathy, you have understanding, you have care. But when it comes to this, a lot of people are left confused. And you're absolutely right again that unlike a lot of things, you cannot keep this from your kid. Unless you live on a completely isolated mountaintop that nobody in the world goes to, your kid is going to hear about this. It doesn't matter if you have an internet connection. It doesn't matter if he has unrestricted screen time. He's just going to hear about it.
Well, even, you know, there may be a few of my friends here peers out on the hilltop, but not very many. Even there, they still have a dish and access.
Exactly.
So they're going to hear about it, but, you know, some of these things that are difficult. Again, I keep coming back to the image that seems so prevalent of the young boy alone in his room looking at the internet. You know, they don't have a girlfriend. you know, why, what is this? This is so unfair. This is so unjust. I'm a good guy. I'm not that bad looking. Why none of these, you know, I deserve to have a girlfriend and one that, you know, fits the my type, the kind of girl that I would like to have. And that whole incel, involuntary celibacy, right? The word went involuntary celibacy is, again, this whole part of this whole preying on young boys. I guess Andrew Tate's part of that. That's a name that comes up a lot. I don't know, maybe it's worth talking about him because maybe a lot of the people listening don't know who he is and how he represents, he's not the only one, but a lot of the people that are out there that are promoting this.
Yeah, Tate is a perfect singular example, like a single guy example of a lot of these things that I'm talking about. You know, a perfect example of one of these fitness influencer people, you know, somebody who got famous because he's strong. He originally was a professional kickboxer. But then he pivoted and his whole career became being rich and dating beautiful women on the internet. And that was his whole thing. But a lot of his content was aimed towards not people his age, you know, he's, I think, 30 or 40. A lot of his content was aimed at preteens or early teenage boys, so like 10 to 18, right? And most of his content was really pessimistic, and it remains really pessimistic. He's still producing stuff. And essentially what it says is, like, you're not going to be able to get the life you want unless you are big and rich and strong, just like me. It preys on young men's insecurities, their beliefs that in order to be a man, they have to be a particular set of things that maybe they physically can't be. You know, not everybody can get big and muscular and strong, and certainly not everybody can be rich, and certainly not everybody can be a supermodel. But these influencers tell young men that unless you are all of those things, no women will want you. And they simultaneously tell young men that you deserve to get exactly the kind of woman that you want. And by get, they do mean that in a literal sense. They mean to tell young men, and so there is a generation of young men that believe that they have a right to have sex with the people that they want to have sex with. That kind of sort of like creating themselves as an oppressed class of people, that's a really huge part of how fascists organize young men today. It's one of those other ways, like I was talking about like, you know, parenting or restricting. Like if you yell at a kid, then he feels shut out from your community, and the only one that he can be in now is the fascist community. This works exactly the same way. He's saying, like, okay, you don't understand how hard it is to be me and to be trying to date. You don't understand how hard it is to look like I do or to feel like I feel, and I can't get what I want. I deserve what I want. It's transforming these sort of like personal embarrassments, you know, asking somebody out who doesn't want to go out with you, transforming that into a political problem.
So I do want to open up the phone lines. There's not a huge amount of time left. I'm sure people are very interested in this topic and have some comments. The number here, 707-923-3911. If you have a question or a comment for Craig Johnson, and maybe something you've experienced in your own parenting or own life about this fascistic tendencies and the push towards how that alienates people. I want to talk a little bit about, you know, people say, okay, what are the other? We've talked about social media. We've talked about Andrew Tate. A popular notion is that games, you know, playing video games or computer games or the various games that are available, so many of them are so violent. But there's no real clear evidence that in and of itself pushes kids into this kind of white supremacist or fascist mindset. But there is an online community of people who kind of use that gamer community to get at kids and promote that fascist train of thought. You mentioned Gamergate. Maybe that's something you can talk about a little bit.
Absolutely. So it's absolutely true that lots of people look at video games themselves and blame that for the rise of fascism. I'm in my mid-30s. I played video games when I was a kid. I'm not a fascist. Neither are most people who played video games. But the thing that fascism is good at is putting itself inside of small little cultures and taking them over. So like I was talking about fitness before, obviously there's nothing inherently fascist about bodybuilding. It's just a sport. But fascists use it as one of these Trojan horses. Video game culture is the same way. They use it as a way to get people to become more fascist. Gamergate is a perfect example of this. It was a political movement, mostly online, but also in person. And it started in the 2010s. And it was an anti-Semitic movement that centered on insulting particular female game makers and games journalists. And the idea was exactly the same sort of move that I've been talking about, where fascists take a problem that they have, a sort of personal problem. I don't like this video game. This girl doesn't like me. I didn't get the job that I want. And they transform it in their imagination into an enormous societal level political disaster, right? Video games are being taken away. Companies are lying to you. There's a conspiracy. Feminism has corrupted women, right? It's exactly this same sort of logic. These personal problems get inflated and become huge, big societal level issues.
I let me jump in here. I'm sorry. I thought we had a caller, but I guess not. Oh, okay. Keep going. Maybe that caller will call back or someone else will call in 707-923-3911.
Absolutely.
No, continue that, because I think, as you mentioned, there have been some pretty effective women involved in the gaming community who were, you know, part of the, you know, creative forces behind that and creating games that were not necessarily sexist. And yet they were vilified by that Gamergate community and many of them forced out.
Absolutely. What fascists have tried to do is to use game culture as a wedge. Their assumption, and it happens to be true in the United States especially, their assumption is that most people who play video games are men and that most of them are young. And so they think, and they saw this as a really perfect little community that they could invade and use. Of course, they're simply wrong about what video games are and what they're for and who they're for. Video games are art. They're for anybody. If you don't like this one, okay, don't play it. In the same way that, like, well, not every movie is made for you. If you don't like it, don't watch it. Like, that's fine, right? But they've used the sort of insular nature of gaming subcultures because it's, despite the fact that it's big, big, big business, it's still sort of like not fully on the inside of mainstream culture. They've used this sort of like insular nature of it, the fact that it's this own world by itself, to try to get the people who are in it to experience any change to it as a challenge to them and their identity and their life. That's a big part of what they do in general. Any challenge, any change is perceived as an attack.
Again, I want to remind the listeners, this is Global Stuff. My name's Jimmy Derschlag. We're talking with Craig Johnson about his book and his work, exposing the fascism that's affecting not only the U.S. and, as he points out, around the world. If you read the book, there's a lot of examples of fascist organizations and tendencies and political parties, not just in the United States. How to Talk to Your Son About Fascism is his new book. Again, the number here, 707-923-3911. Well, let's get into this issue. Okay, you're a parent. And as you point out, it's a little different depending on the age of your son. When he's younger, but you say it's important to have these conversations early. So how would you start that with your kid, or at least to be tuned in, or at least to, you know, to kind of, especially someone who's online a lot, maybe you're fairly loose. He has his own phone and certainly communicates through apps with his friends. How would you open that and try and keep those communications going?
Yeah, I mean, it really depends, as you said, on the age of a kid. When I'm talking about the people who, like talking about the ages of the kids that need to be dealt with, that need to be talked to when it comes to this, I generally say that the age is somewhere between 10 and 25. But obviously, engaging with your 10-year-old son is going to be very different from engaging with your 25-year-old son, right? Your 10-year-old kid will still be taking advice from you, will still be taking suggestions, is still really looking up to you as a mentor. At 25, we're mostly talking about an equal.
Right.
And this is one of the main differences between talking to your kid about fascism and talking to them about anything else. This is politics. They can believe whatever they want.
Let me jump in because I don't want to lose the callers, and we do have a couple. So, hi, you're on the air. You have a question for Dr. Johnson? Hello? Are you there? Do we lose them?
Hear me?
No, here you are. Hello?
This is the same argument, unfortunately, that we on the left have been facing from the right as long as I can remember, relative to their depiction of communists and leftists and all that insanity. How do you differentiate and in your approach to dealing with the kids or other humans relative to same? And I'll take my answer off the air.
All right. That's a great question. I think that's a legitimate point.
It is.
Thank you.
Thanks for the question. The reason that I wrote this book about fascism as opposed to extremism is the violence point that I was talking about earlier. Unlike other, you know, non-mainstream political positions like communism or socialism, fascists believe that violence is good. Fascists are dangerous in a very unique and different way. This isn't to say that socialists and communists haven't committed violence in the past. They certainly have. But the difference is that all fascists believe in violence and will be violent. It's part of their politics, which is very different. There have been nonviolent socialists and communists, and that is the reason that I wanted to write this book about fascism as opposed to extremism in general.
And I would point out in the book, you mentioned how Antifa has been vilified, and it simply means anti-fascist, and yet the people who bring it up, such as our president, often imply that this is a violent group, which it is not. And you also say to anyone who's reading the book and is against fascism, welcome to the cause. You're part of Antifa.
If you do not want the world to be fascist, you are part of Antifa, by definition.
And we do have another caller, I believe. Hi, you're on the air.
Hey, sorry about that last one, cell phone drop. Are you guys listening to yourself? You're almost vilifying an entire generation of young men. And from what I'm listening to, I picked up a few minutes after you started, but this is my impression, is that you are fear-mongering to a certain extent an entire generation of young males who, in this society that has been going, whichever way you want to call it, but that has been going down a dark path, I believe, and you're talking about violence is always on their manifesto. Have we lived through the last 5 months together when you had Democratic Party leaders burnt talking about getting out in the streets and getting violent and getting up in people's faces?
I don't think that's true. I never heard a Democratic leader say to get out in the streets and get violent. That is not true. It's just not true. You can say it, but it's not true. Democratic leaders have not proposed violence. They've proposed objecting to what's happening with the government, but you're not, it's not correct. It's just not, it's not accurate.
I would also add that, you know, exactly one politician has been assassinated in this Trump's
Democratic operatives burning down Teslas and keying Teslas and getting arrested for it. Are you kidding me?
Do you recall last week when a sitting Democratic legislator was assassinated in her home?
Yeah, and also that murder has so many different conspiracy theories going with it right now, including tied back to Tim Walz, the governor of Minnesota.
And you believe that? You believe that Tim Walz killed this person?
Thank you. Thank you for identifying that.
I'm sorry. I'm sorry. We cannot support that. What we're trying to talk about is getting the people to talk to each other without using violence against each other, and trying to get parents to understand what's happening with their kids so they can talk to them and reach a reasonable place with them. I don't buy it. Sorry, caller.
I would say that this is a perfect example of why yelling at people to change their minds does not work.
Okay, we've got another call. Hi, you're on the air. There you are.
Yeah, you know, disembarking on the patriarchy. And those sort of liberal or left-wing values kind of mix in communities. It goes multiple generations. It's relied on law enforcement, you know, and sort of fascism. And then the policies and procedures of the local government slowly start to contract, where the people start to have less and less rights to be heard. Over time, those factions then, you know, those coalitions between the liberals, I mean, the left-wingers and the Democrats essentially have racist kind of attitudes, and also those fascists and the kids that are also the kids of those multiple generations, even when they married, even our community, for example, these things are going on. And the judges and the sheriff and the DA's office are all in on it. So how do you know when all of this micro bureaucracy has contracted so much, and this, you know, hidden evil is happening through continued negative inferencing and alleging things that maybe power might be out of balance?
I would say that fascism doesn't need conspiracy. Fascists operate out in the open. They tell you exactly what they're going to do. Like, Donald Trump doesn't lie to you about his intentions. He tells you, hey, I don't believe in elections, and I don't care if I lost, I won. I don't care what the court says, I'm going to do it anyway. I don't care if it's illegal, I'm going to do it. Fascists, like I say in the book, and like we were talking about in this talk on the radio earlier, fascists don't play by the rules. They don't care about the rules. They don't hide. They operate right out in the open.
Out in the open of the majority, right? In a populist way?
I mean, so one of the things about fascism is that it appeals to a lot of people. You're right. It is relatively popular. And that's not just in the United States. It's been popular for a long time, including back in fascist Italy and Nazi Germany as well. That's one of the reasons they don't need to hide, is that lots of people just simply like it.
I think we have.
Didn't it happen also in the ideals of National Socialism in 1900 with the National Women's Social Movement of Italy? But that, yet that utopian dream hated the anti-utopian nightmare.
Yeah, fascists are revolutionaries. They want to build a new world, and usually that ends in tears.
And the mechanisms of power, I would say guns are much greater than politics.
I don't know if I agree with you there.
Let's move on. We do have another caller. No, we don't.
Rural America right now is going through huge problems with their criminal justice systems. And rural America, you know, is really having this sort of, you know, especially here in Humboldt County, determining, you know, we're going to do it our way. And this is the way that we've done it for years. And this is how we do it. And if you're not part of the game, then we'll roll you down the 101.
I mean, it sounds to me like you're talking about corruption, which to me is different from fascism. Corruption is normal. Fascism is something new and different to be incorporated into the everyday functions of the United States government.
You know, we don't have much time left. I'm I'm sorry, caller. I appreciate your viewpoint, but you know, if you don't have a question, we're going to move on. We do have one more, you said? Okay. We can probably fit one more in. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Yeah, I'd just like to get the guest's take real quick on the foreign policy of fascist political parties, which the Republican Party clearly has become a fascist political party. What we're seeing in the Middle East and elsewhere, where they seem to be, at least, you know, the people who are going to make a lot of money off this, really, really hungry for war. And Donald Trump appears to, you know, be doing their bidding, or at least, you know, Benjamin Netanyahu's bidding. What is the fascist outcome, you think, in the United States of America as a result of the Republican Party running everything now? Are we going to be going into World War III?
Talking about foreign policy is a really important thing to bring up here. You're absolutely right. Fascist foreign policy in some ways isn't going to look entirely different from the U.S. foreign policy recently, because fascist foreign policy is about violence. It's about war. I fully expect Donald Trump to continue to engage in illegal strikes on supposed enemy countries of the United States. He may or may not do that at the behest of ally countries of the United States, such as, you know, the European Union or Ukraine or Israel. It's absolutely true that the fascists believe in violence. They like violence. They want violence. And they also cooperate with the companies that produce weapons and things like that. Although greasing those wheels is, you know, that doesn't require fascists either, right? That's
pray, that's all free, that's summer all breeze, pretty girls and sunscreen. It's summer in the USA.
I think we just got some music on the air that we didn't expect. You get a preview of Shaka's show coming up. That's live community radio for you. But you're still on, Craig.
Yeah, just to conclude there, that when it comes to foreign policy, fascists, they operate foreign policy in the same way that they operate domestic policy. It's all about enemies. It's all about who's in and who's out. And they define who is outside of the community by killing them, by attacking them. And so we see this on the streets, you know, with ICE taking people wantonly without warrants, without warning, without arrests. And we see that same kind of illegal violence in foreign policy.
Well, we don't. We only have a couple of minutes left. I just want to say that you have some great advice in the book. For example, starting a conversation with your son about what's going on in his life and what he's heard about fascism. That, as most parents know, especially parents of boys, I think it's not exclusive to boys, they're not going to start the conversation with you. You're going to have to initiate it yourself. And we haven't gone into that in detail. You have some great ways to start and listen. And I think that's so important, your talk about empathy and listening and being supportive of your son. And there's so much more in this book that we didn't even begin to get to.
The big takeaway that I'd love for people to have is that fascists, like I said, they're prepared for violence. They're prepared for anger. They're prepared for yelling. What they're not prepared for is empathy and kindness and curiosity and care. I'm not telling you to coddle people for fascist ideas. I'm telling you to show love for the people in your community and to help them if they make a mistake and they're willing to make amends.
Well, thanks so much for making the time to be with us, Dr. Johnson, Dr. Craig Johnson from University of California at Berkeley. He has the 15 Minutes of Fascism podcast, and his book is How to Talk to Your Son About Fascism. Thanks to Dennis for juggling the phones there in the video, in the Zoom. And my name's Jimmy Derschlag. This has been Global Stuff.
This has been a KMUD podcast. To listen to other shows and more episodes of this show, find us on all the platforms where you get your podcast, and also on our website, kmud.org.